The following podcast is an Embassy Row production. We are here today to bury the idea that restaurants in NYC are dead.
NYC is the mecca of food, and anyone that says otherwise has either never been here or is lying to themselves.
Where else can you find the best Chinese food right across the street from the worst Chinese food you've ever had?
Mexican food better than LA, and you don't have to drive to it.
Pizza better than the Chicago deep dish, whatever the fuck they call it. It's too deep. If you're a pizza that takes a fork and a knife to eat, then guess what? You're a fucking lasagna, you bready bitch.
And I will stand by this. Every single bodega should be Zagat rated. I guarantee you, a standard chopped cheese you get in Harlem at 3 a.m. should have at least one Michelin star.
The only way for this city to sustain its culinary community was to become one of the biggest employers in New York.
In 2019, NYC had 23,650 food establishments.
That's a total of 317,800 jobs. 1 in 12 private sector jobs in NYC were restaurant-based in 2019.
Plus, 60% of workers in restaurants were migrants, giving them a path to stability in the most intense place to live in the world.
And the money, I mean, listen, restaurants paid out $10.7 billion in total wages citywide, with nearly $27 billion in taxable sales.
And then Corona fucked it all up. 17% of restaurants shut down nationally. That equaled 91,000 lost jobs in New York in April 2020 alone, putting this city's culinary future into question.
Restaurants were forced to shut down indoor seating, adopt takeout and delivery practices, and eventually move to outdoor dining.
There is this increasing feeling of uncertainty about the state of the restaurant industry in New York City, which begs the question,
are restaurants in NYC dead?
Tom Levine, I'm a comedian and writer who has been featured in the New York Times, and I've avoided jury duty for 5 years running.
I'm Drexen Clemens. I'm a comedian and writer from Atlanta living in New York City. I work with BuzzFeed News, and I only go to Staten Island if I'm driving through it.
This is NYC is Dead, a podcast focused on proving how alive this city actually is. Every week, we speak with New Yorkers that have direct influence and insight into the industries that this city is famous for, and hear how it's changed in the wake of 2020.
At the end of each episode, we'll get a little closer to answering the question, is NYC dead? So our first interview happened at Comfortland. I don't know if you guys have ever been to Comfortland or Astoria, New York City. Let me tell you something. This is an oasis of beauty and like the best food ever in the Trumpiest part of NYC other than Long Island.
That's the thing about the area that Comfortland is in, is that it's Greeks, it's Indian food. The area that Comfortland in is the definition of a melting pot, food-wise.
Except Black people. If for
Except
whatever
no
reason,
Black people
there's
food.
No Black people in Astoria. Yeah. I was the only one when I was there. When I lived in Astoria for all of 2 weeks, my mission was to find anything seasoned.
No.
And when I tell you, Comfortland was the only place that I found that I was like, oh my God, this tastes like home. This feels good.
In a sea of Spanakopita, Comfortland stands above all the rest.
You have to go to Comfortland, okay? Yeah. And if you're not going to Comfortland for the food, which I don't know why you wouldn't, at least go for the service, because they have some of the most hype, fun servers I've ever seen in New York City. And we got to talk to one very, very fun guy. His name is Matthew. Let's go ahead and roll that tape.
I've been working as a server for about 4 years now. And I've been at Comfortland since June of last year.
Explain Comfortland to me.
Comfortland is comfort food in the heart of Astoria that's amazingly delicious, that's highly addictive, and that will change the way you look at all other foods if you come ever. I work here because I came here so often as a customer that I knew the whole menu. I literally like survived off this place for like 8 months. I left to move to Hawaii for 6 months, and when I left, the owner was like, yo, how are we going to keep the lights on? I ate here that much.
What do you think people need to know about the service industry that you think most people don't know?
It's not an easy job, even though it seems like an easy job. And I think that a lot of people, they have this thing in their head like, well, this job's not so hard. It's kind of similar to like when a girl is like, oh, I should just be a stripper. Stripping is not an easy job.
Right.
It's like you think it's easy because you don't understand like the mental capacity that it takes to work in a place like this, especially a place that does the volume we do. It's like people crack. Without saying any names, we had a guy who was real great at another spot, and we poached him. Like we wanted him so bad, And I kind of was like, yo, I think that the spot he works at isn't the same pace as ours. So I don't know if he's going to thrive. And everyone was like, nah, he's so great. We think he'll do it. He didn't make it past training. He was like, yo, this job is too stressful. These days are too busy. And he only worked on slow days. It's like a busy day at Comfortland, like a weak person will cry.
Yeah,
like you hide in a bathroom or something. You know what I mean? It's not the easiest thing.
Yeah.
And when you're dealing with like constantly having to talk to people, constantly having to meet people's expectations and do it all like smiling and you can't really react the way you want to, it's really hard. And just having that composure is more difficult than people know. Well, you shouldn't be rude to people, period. But you should especially not be rude to someone who's handling your food, because it's like you don't know how many things are going on behind the scenes. It's like we're falling apart, but you don't care, because people have a very selfish outtake, especially when it comes to ordering food. It's like it becomes about you. It doesn't matter what's ahead of you. It doesn't matter that 60 people could have ordered before you. It's like you're number 60, but you're number one to you.
Right.
And I just feel like people need to be more open-minded about what goes on behind the scenes. And I think especially with COVID, I think a lot of people lost their social conditioning. So they've been acting a little more rude than normal because they're just not used to interacting the same way. You know, we had a guy the other day show up with no mask. And we were like, we're not gonna serve you with no mask. He's like, oh, I ordered online. But it was like, yo, we're still not trying to hand you food with no mask. And so I told him, like, yo, I'm going to hand you your food. Like, I handed him from, like, a good distance. I was like, I'm going to hand you your food. But, like, we're not going to serve you next time if you have no mask. And if you show up for a pickup with no mask, I'm canceling your order. And he's like, that's bullshit. But it's, like, our safety. You don't have consideration for our safety. You have consideration for your dinner
that's
or your lunch.
That's fascinating, though, that people are ruder since Corona.
Yo, people are ruder and people tip less.
What? Yeah. I thought it was at the beginning of Corona, it was this whole, like, oh, my God, essential workers. We have to tip them. They're the ones delivering.
Yo, by, like, the token of, like, oh, people are tipping more, that's to pat themselves on the back. It's like you leave a tip because you want to feel like you did some nice shit, but you're not actually doing it because you're a good tip or because you're a good person. And you might do this shit once. Last year, when all the civil unrest was going on because of all the shit that was happening with the police department, I worked in a bar that was co-owned by a black woman. So we got on a list of all these black-owned businesses. And we had so many one-time customers that wanted to support black businesses. But they would call and they'd place like $80 orders. And then after placing the order, like after I processed the order, before payment, they'd be like, but you are a black-owned business, right? So it's like during COVID, I think people lost their shit, like in terms of like just how things work, like situations like that. Like, I understand supporting black owned businesses and I do that shit all the time. And I was doing that shit before it was like a cool thing to do. But to be a one time purchaser to say, oh, I did it, is like some dickhead shit. To be a one time person who gave like a good tip once and then from now on you don't tip is crazy. And also, like, some things people don't deem tippable. If you buy coffee, you should tip. If you buy a donut, you should tip. It's like, people be like, oh, but it's just coffee. I don't got to tip. But I still got to make you the fucking coffee. Like, you know, and it's still like a courtesy. I'm still risking my health to serve you. We're in a situation where most people could just get unemployment and not work. And we're choosing to come to work and possibly make less without the tips. So it's weird. But tipping in COVID has been a very interesting, like, ebb and flow.
What's it at now?
It's low, yeah. People, we had, like, it was, like, a good run. I think when people are happier, when it's summertime and people are out, they're, like, spending more. But during the winter, even people who used to tip don't tip, and tips have gotten lighter. And it's, like, you'll get, like, a $50 order, and someone will give you a $1 tip.
Do you think that it's coinciding with, like, unemployment benefits and, like, the stimulus package? Like,
I definitely think that people are running out of money. Like, that's always my thing. It's, like, oh, like, you see orders get smaller, oh, they're running out of money, and just like, too many factors.
Comfortland is sort of like a bellwether for the rest of the economy.
Yeah, if Comfortland's doing well, you know the economy's doing well. If it's not...
Some things are recession-proof. If someone's having a bad day, they might want a donut. If someone's having a good day, they might want a donut.
If someone's a cop...
Donut. Someone got arrested by a cop, donut.
Whenever a cop comes to Comfortland, like if we get a noise complaint or if we get a complaint, because sometimes we have DJs, I always offer them donuts. And, you know, cops always come in with their partner. And always one of the cops is like, yeah. And the other cop is like, I'm not going to be the stereotype. Right. Like, we are not taking free donuts from you today.
Do you guys get a lot of cops over here?
We get some. Like, I wouldn't say we get too many. Like, I think cops more likely to go to, like, a diner, because a lot of cops eat for free in certain diners.
Really?
Yeah.
In Astoria or just like
in a lot of places.
I didn't know.
Yo, Astoria's got hardcore free cop than a diner 100%. Energy, dude.
If I see more than one American flag on a diner in Astoria, I'm like, first of all, I'm not allowed to go in here. And second, cops eat for free. Also, if you've killed someone, you eat for free always.
We're doing this interview in Little Blue Lives Matterville.
100%.
Like, when all this stuff was going on, we were, like, the only place on the block to have, like, a Breonna Taylor, like, thing.
I remember that.
And right next door at the print shop, they had a vote for Trump sign.
What?
And it was so weird because they're Indian. And it was so weird to, like, have that dynamic between two neighboring spots. It's like people would come in and be like, he had, like, a big ass because he was using it as an advertisement for his signs.
Oh,
so he has a big ass Donald
what a
Trump
way to
sign.
Advertise
That's
a Trump
the worst
sign. Like,
way.
Look, I need to buy a Trump sign. I don't know where to buy it. I'm going to go to this place right here.
Like, oh, you can get your sign. Vote for Trump.
Yeah, it's like, hey, we make fat heads. It's just a picture of a Jared the Subway guy.
We'll give you 20% off if you show us your ballot. I will say this. Comfortland staff is like one of the greatest staffs I've ever worked with. Everyone shows up to work super ill. Super happy, like ready to do what we do. We accept all challenges. Like we'll get a text at like 11 at night the night before, like, yo, I want to sell a record number of donuts tomorrow. Are you guys down? And it's like, yeah. And then we do it, and it's like, you guys did it. And then the boss will buy us like dinner from somewhere, and we'll go off. You know what I mean? But Comfortland is fucking crazy because it's an interesting area of where food meets creativity. Like any of us can give an idea. They'll make that shit. Like, let's try it.
Are restaurants dead in New York City?
Hell no. They never will be. Because there's one thing is true about New Yorkers. We love to fucking eat. And we're never going to stop. And people don't come here to not eat. This is one of the food capitals of the world. And we don't take that shit lightly. So there's always going to be a way. There's always going to be restaurants in New York. Like, ain't no ever going to be like, oh, New York ran out of restaurants. And secondly... Motherfuckers don't cook.
They really don't hear. Motherfuckers don't cook. We can't afford kitchens.
Well, it's not even that they can't afford kitchens. It's that when you bust your ass to pay a New York rent, you don't want to come home and chop some fucking onions for 17 minutes to make some sauce. And you can only eat Prego so often before you start feeling like shit. Right. Or before the Italians in the neighborhood ridicule you.
That's my problem. In my neighborhood, all the Italians are like,
oh, this is the guy.
What?
Oh, ragu face over here. New York is always going to be a mecca when it comes to food because it's one of those rare melting pots, especially Queens. I'm a very big advocate for food in Queens because we have every ethnicity you can imagine. Like, we've got it all. And when you come here, a lot of people's experiences are tailored around food. It's very similar to Louisiana. It's very similar to Los Angeles, where people are going to come and it's like, you go to LA, you want Roscoe's. You go to Louisiana, you're going to end up popping into Cafe Du Monde. Like, you don't go to places and not do that shit. If you go to New York, you're going to get pizza. Like, you're going to get a fucking hot dog off the street. You're going to get halal guys. You're going to do whatever the fuck you do. But we're a staple, you know? And so restaurants will always be alive in New York.
Yo, great. Thank you so much, man.
It's my pleasure.
Some of you guys may not know listening is that me and Drexton, we have a live show in Central Park that every Thursday and Saturday we have comics come in and perform with us in Central Park. And lately we've been doing audio recordings at those shows. So we had the opportunity to interview a bunch of the audience at a recent show about their different restaurant experiences. And this is interviews from our last show.
Tell us your restaurant story, Ari.
Okay, so I'm a Jew, you know, so I love sushi.
I know, because after you said, I know, you know.
I know, listen, I'm a Jew, and this is my bar mitzvah. Okay, so I order sushi maybe 3 times a week, like a lot of sushi. So I order from this place on the Upper East Side. I get the sushi, I start eating a nice little Philadelphia roll. I bite into
which is the most American.
Oh, I'm like the Chipotle of sushi.
I feel like every time you order a Philadelphia roll, someone in Japan cries.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
hey, this isn't even what we wanted.
So I bite into a Philadelphia roll, and I taste something that I shouldn't taste. There's a sensation in my mouth, and I pull it. It's hard. Yeah, I pull it out, and it is
a piece of the Liberty Bell.
It's not far from that. It is a screw.
Oh!
Yeah, it's worse than the Cinnamon Toast Crunch shrimp tail situation.
Oh.
We're talking industrial equipment in my food.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I call the sushi place, and I'm like, hey, I just found a screw in my sushi roll. And they're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, I don't know how to else to say what I mean. I mean, I found a screw in my sushi roll. And they're like, why? And I'm like, listen, I don't, you're asking me the right, ask the people that work there. So they're like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to send somebody to come pick up the screw.
Why can't you just like send them a picture?
Well, they thought that I was like lying that I had put the screw in my own sushi roll to get, I don't know what, but.
Wait, but then if they were to go there, it wouldn't prove anything.
Wait, you're asking the right question.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
So the guy comes to my apartment. He knocks on my door, and I open the door, and I go, are you here to pick up the screw? And like, it felt like I got drugged here. So he goes, yes. And I go, okay, I've decided I'm not going to give the screw to you. I'm going to walk with you to the sushi place, and I'm going to present the screw to show you that it's like an honest, like I'm not like pulling the fast one. So we're walking up Second Avenue to the sushi place. I walk in, and I, you know, the weird thing about ordering food in New York is that you don't know, when you're ordering online, you don't know what the grade of the restaurant is. Does everyone have a restaurant that you've ordered from and you've never actually been to the restaurant?
I will say, anytime I see a bodega that I recognize from Grubhub, it's like a little celebrity moment. Right. I'm just like, oh my God.
So,
oh, Adam Clayton Powell Grocery? No way. I got my eggs from.
So I've never actually been to the restaurant. I don't know what the grade is. Okay, so I show up to the restaurant. What grade do you think this sushi? I have been ordering from this sushi place 4 days a week for 5 years.
I'm gonna go C.
Okay, so you guys think it's a C. Okay. I show up. D.
Whoa! Yes. Don't they close you after a C?
I thought they closed you.
That's what I thought, okay? To give you an idea, you know the food that's like half eaten on the top of trash cans? You know that?
Yeah.
That's a C, okay? D, I mean, literally, I was repulsed at myself because I've been eating this place for 5 years. I go in, we're presenting the screw. It felt like a weird drug deal. I give them the screw. They comp my food, which was nice. And then I walk back outside and I go, how have I never, because I walk by the place. I'm like, how have I never not noticed that it's a D? And I look and they had hidden the D on the front window in a udon soup. They used the D in udon. They made the other letters of udon look like a sanitation sign. And I'm like, not a... I left the situation was like, I'm not even mad. I'm honestly impressed.
That's not a D. That's a D that they know they're going to keep.
They earned that D.
They earned a D. I mean, I would have thought when it's a D, they just burn the place down for the insurance money. They're staying open. I was impressed.
Do you still order for them?
Of course I do. I mean, what am I going to do?
If we work our way up to a B, it's an Ubon.
If they improve, then you'll notice because it's going to be like crab ragoon.
Right.
One day.
It's going to just.
Bulgogi. Right.
It just keeps getting better until there's no signs on the front when they finally have an egg in 30 years.
Give it up for Ari Finlay.
Now, I may be personally biased because as a person that identifies as 96.5% Ashkenazi Jew, according to a 23andMe, I think that the only way to do a trip into New York, no trip is complete without eating a bunch of pastrami, just like two pieces of bread, huge stack of pastrami in the middle. And when it comes to large sandwiches in New York, there's no restaurant more known in the world for large sandwiches than Katz's Deli on the Lower East Side. Drex, you've never been there. What did you think about it when you went there?
When I walked in there, it was amazing. There were celebrity pictures everywhere, which for me, that's a cosign, okay?
Mm-hmm. No deli is complete in New York without a wall full of celebrities that are very New York-centric, like the cast of Law & Order.
Exactly. And I'm not talking Mariska. I'm talking OG Law & Order.
That's right. You're not a real deli in New York until Jerry Arbach is on the wall.
Until Dick Wolf walks into your deli. Mm-hmm. All right. You're not a New York deli, okay?
Until you bite into a sandwich sandwich and you hear someone go behind you, you're not eating a real sandwich. And that is honestly, listen, I know that there's no done coming out of the walls, but it feels like that at Katz's because it's that New York-y of an institution.
Their food is so good, it's a crime. Okay. Not only did we get to interview Jake Dell, the owner of Katz Deli, but stick around because I get to try pastrami for the very first time.
You're going to want to hear how this goes. Jake talked to us a little bit, not only about the history of the restaurant, but the history of meats in general, about the immigrant experience for Jews who came over after the Holocaust and how that sort of shaped the culinary world and the deli world in New York specifically.
And he also gave us some really good insight to how restaurants are dealing with things pre, during, and post-pandemic.
Katz's is a great example of a restaurant that was functioning one way before the pandemic and had to completely swap their entire production line, their entire way of doing things. It was a super interesting interview. And this is our interview with Jake Dell. Jake, so first tell me about Katz's. Tell me about you.
Yeah, my name is Jake. I'm the fifth generation owner here at Katz's Deli on the Lower East Side. We've been here 133 years. We are the oldest and I objectively believe best deli, but maybe that's not objective. but you know, this is a very old food tradition. This is turn of the century, as in 1880s, you know, to 1900s, food tradition that you really don't see in a lot of places. And we very much maintain that tradition, keep it going well. And now it's my turn to do that. You know, I'm hopefully do it the same way my father and uncle did it and my grandfather did it, and we'll see.
You talked to me about the origins of Katz's.
So, I mean, at that point, delis were really a dime a dozen, right? I mean, delis were on every block. You had a dozen on this block alone. You know, they're kind of like bagel shops or pizza places today. You had a deli everywhere. It's a very specific food tradition. It's Eastern European Jewish immigrants who came to this country in the mid to late 1800s. Mm-hmm. That is the origin of deli. It's not the bodega. It's you know, this food tradition, pastrami's, corned beefs, briskets, matzo ball soups, things like that. It's about food preservation and making it taste good. You know, when you don't have refrigeration and you got a big hunk of meat, what are you supposed to do? You salt the crap out of it. And you smoke it, and that gives a flavor and it preserves it, and you can feed your whole family for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And that's really the deli tradition. It wasn't about an Instagram picture for a really large sandwich with cheese dripping down. You know, you wouldn't have cheese on a sandwich. Most of these people are kosher or kosher style. So that's where it's really born, is this very specific thing. Over the years, deli has made its way across the country and made its way back, and in the process gained things like a Reuben sandwich, right? Or
explain a Reuben to me.
Quote unquote traditional Reuben would be corned beef with sauerkraut, melted Swiss, and a Russian dressing. Now, I put that in quotations because it really isn't a classic deli sandwich, right? You wouldn't have cheese on a sandwich. Even if you weren't kosher, which we were not, you still wouldn't have cheese in the store. That was reserved for dairy shops. Places like Ratner's are probably the only one people would still know today. Quick aside, you know, you have your delis, you have your dairy shops, and you have your appetizing stores. Places like Russ and Daughters are the appetizing. Fish there, meat here. Dairy and dairy shops.
How much meat do you guys go through a week?
Pre-pandemic, it would be as high as about average week, 25 to 30,000 pounds of meat a week. Busy holiday time, about 40,000 pounds of meat. You know, that's dropped obviously, but we're ticking back up. We're probably in that 20 some odd thousand pounds. Pastrami alone can account for half of that. And that takes about a month to make all in start to finish with the curing, the smoking and the boiling.
So, okay. So then what constitutes a traditional sandwich and what are things that people add to sandwiches that shouldn't even be on sandwiches?
So I should say very, very early days, it wasn't actually even sandwiches. It was just hunks of meat, slabs of meat, you know, by the pound. And you would go to your bakery for your bread and you wouldn't necessarily have a sandwich here, right? So that came later. But we've had sandwiches long enough that I guess I can answer this question.
Wait, when did sandwiches get into the mix?
It's really hard to tell these things. You know, sometime in the teens or 20s.
Right around sliced bread. Right around Betty White.
Yeah. Probably a strong correlation to the sliced bread. Shit, that's funny. So classic is this. It's mustard.
Okay.
And it's the end of the discussion.
That's it.
You want mayo on a sandwich? Fine. but I'm going to judge the crap out of you.
Okay.
I'll probably give you shit. I might kick you out. But you do what you want.
Right.
I'll say that it's anti-Semitic. If you put mayonnaise on a corned beef, on a pastrami directly with no other thing, that's an affront to my people.
That's so wait. And I don't disagree.
I'm so confused here because we've traditionally thought of mayo as a white thing. And then if you're like, you can't do it. So
yeah, we're fake white.
We're fake whole white. Other so, Jews yeah. are yeah, so white, it's a disability.
If anything, we're more black than we are white.
Oh, God.
Yeah, we're fake white.
Okay.
They don't like us. They don't want us in their clubs.
Yeah.
So then who was like, look, the real test is mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't exactly. like mayonnaise.
Non-Jews are whites on the stage, and then the Jews are the whites in the back just got being like, okay, just make sure you get there on time. Okay, that's it.
Look, we have a lot of holidays this year. Yeah, yeah, we don't have a lot of sauces. Okay? Yeah. We have white sauce.
We have networking seders. I don't think there's ever a networking church Sunday morning. Talk to me about Katz's, because Katz's history-wise.
Yes,
is, I mean,
a very long history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is our 133rd year, 15th decade, if you think about it that way, which is pretty wild. So, but what you see here has looked the exact same since the 40s. Some of these neon signs in the back are originals. That Budweiser sign is from 1954.
Oh, wow.
Anheuser-Busch came in and tried to take the sign and switch it out for a newer sign. So we want to put it in the museum, in the Anheuser-Busch Museum. I was like, I didn't know there was an Anheuser-Busch Museum. Like, who's going to that? But also, no, you're not getting my fucking neon.
Do they fight back?
They're like, well, we'll give you 3 neons. So I was like, nah.
I like the send a salami to the soldiers
yeah.
stuff that goes around.
So that's been our slogan since World War II.
Okay.
And some of those signs are original. And it rhymes if you say it like a real New Yorker.
Yeah. Hey, send a salami. Run the army. Hey, come on, hey. Hey, yo.
Yeah.
How much did the original sandwich cost here at Katz Deli?
I have no fucking idea.
We tried.
Yeah. I mean, pennies, a nickel. I know that in the early 60s, it was 95 cents, I believe. In the 70s, I believe $3 or $4. Basically, inflation.
Inflation.
Yeah.
So like, it was like, hey, we have like, I'll give you a goat. Here, can I have a goat? And then they're like, I can't keep giving you goats. Inflation.
Yeah.
And they just started buying pennies.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, quick question: What is the New York restaurant obsession with filling up your wall with celebrities? I feel like it's like Joe's Pizza. That's you guys.
And then talk to us also about some of the bigger ones on the wall.
Right. So you can tell the older the picture, the larger it is sometimes because we had more wall space and. And then we're like, shit, we're running out of space. So we went from like a, I don't even know what size that is, like a 40 by 50, like massive, versus to like a 2x2.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just coincidence. You guys just don't love the Law and Order cast more than other people.
I mean, to be fair, Jerry Orbach is the single greatest Law and Order detective ever.
Yeah.
I beg to dip. Ice-T is doing a phenomenal job. Okay.
You know, fair, Ice-T is great.
Ice-T ran... because Jerry Orbach walked.
He gave his eye.
He gave his eye. If I ever go blind, I want Ice-T's eyes. Yeah. The Danny DeVito one was very funny.
Danny DeVito one was a lot of fun. He was like exactly what you would expect Danny DeVito to be like. Like, yeah, I went up to him, I was like, oh, we're chatting, we're schmoozing. I was like, oh, do you want to join the wall? And he goes, son, what's your name again? Jake. I've been on this wall since before you were fucking born. And I was like, okay, well, this is kind of awkward because I think your picture is not on the wall right now. And he's like, all right, fine, get the fuck over here. We'll take the fucking picture. And I was like, all right, cool, yeah.
Talk to me about the Harry Met Sally thing. Let's talk about that.
Harry Met Sally, yeah. The famous orgasm scene was here. So Nora Ephron, who was the writer, Rob Reiner, and Billy Crystal were all regulars here, and they're eating here, and they're talking about this new movie. They're like, well, we got to write Katz's into it somehow. And they're like, yeah, well, this scene might be good for it. And they kind of developed it. They didn't know exactly how it was going to go. And then filming day, she must have faked no less than about 500 orgasms. I mean, it was one after the other. And there's a great story of that Billy Crystal tells where he's sitting at the table and Rob Reiner's just not happy with how the scene's going. And he moves Meg Ryan over and is like, I got this. And sits at the table and starts faking it. Now, keep in mind, the woman who says the I'll have what she's having line is Rob Reiner's mother. So now Billy Crystal, as he tells it, is watching it fake an orgasm with his mother right there. It's like cringing the whole time. Just so uncomfortable.
Do people come in here and fake orgasms?
Yeah, every week.
Every week someone comes in here.
Less so during the pandemic when
right.
When there's like one person in the store and you're like, that's awkward.
Wait, has someone come in here during the pandemic and done it?
No.
Wow.
Oh, we have to do it.
We have to be the first people to do it.
We're gonna do
You're
it.
You're welcome to, yeah, no problem.
Okay, that's what's gonna happen. Yeah. That's how we end this.
Listen, I'll be honest, I've seen, there's nothing that surprises me with it anymore. I've seen young, old, guy, girl.
Podcast host?
I've seen a TV crew from Brazil do it. We had a competition here last year, actually, in honor of the 30th anniversary of the movie.
So let me just verify this. No one has orgasmed in this restaurant since before the pandemic. Like, under.
Well, they might have had a food orgasm.
Yeah, yeah, obviously,
But no one's done the Harry Met Sally.
No one's done it. I will argue that New York is not open again until someone fakes an orgasm in Katz's. Talk to me about what it was like in here before the pandemic, and then what it was like when the pandemic started, and then, you know.
Yeah, no plexiglass, that's for sure. I would say, so pre-pandemic zoo is the easiest way to describe it. Just people everywhere, people at every table, every seat, a lot more seats than there are now. And then early pandemic was not a single person in sight, and we had to cap the total number of people in here, including our staff, which basically meant that, like, we could have four customers at a time. A lot of, like, uncertainty, a lot of chaos, a lot of switching over to shipping, which has done really, really well. And now, fast forward a year later, and it's, like, starting to pick up. You start to feel it. You know, you're seeing some tourists from the tri-state area again. You're starting to see some traffic on the streets and on the sidewalks. It feels like we're there, which is good. Not there, but getting there, and mentally we're getting there. Now we do this two-day shipping model, which is pretty amazing. Customers are pretty happy with it. So the transitions were really about focusing on customers seeing that we ship and, like, getting the messaging out to them, but then also operationally making sure we had enough of everything, right? And packing enough pickles, teaching the bus boy, you know, she's actually a waitress, right? Mm-hmm. And she's working on deliveries right now. I have a bus boy who now knows how to pack mustards, another one who packs pickles. And I mean, when you're talking about thousands and thousands of mustards every week, and I'm not able to either keep up in Jersey or in our warehouse, and I'm not able to have other work for staff that have been here for 20, 30, 40 years. It's just about reassigning roles and reteaching people and making it up as you go, truthfully.
Are restaurants in NYC dead?
It's a stupid question.
This is literally everybody's answer all the time. They're just like, fuck you.
Yeah. How dare you?
Well, I told you when I first, when you told me the name of it, and like I saw, I was like, New York City is dead, wants to do an interview. I was like, fuck these guys. I'm not, I don't want to. No, New York City is not dead. New York City took it in the chin. New York City was really bad this time last year. And a lot of people did flee, yes. And a lot of restaurants will be closed, yes. But to say New York City is dead is to either just be the most condescending human alive, or to not understand what New York is. And to say that New York doesn't have a fighting spirit, New York doesn't have grit, when New York clearly has grit. Like, every part, every neighborhood, every aspect of New York, even the, like, parts that you don't think have grit, have their version of grit, right? They have the work ethic version of grit, like, the doing, like, 27 hours a day, you know? And this is New York. We're fucking fine.
What's your name? Who are you? Speaking to the mic.
Yeah. My name is Andres.
Andres, give it up for Paul and Andres.
What's the restaurant story?
Oh, I'm getting there. Look, I'm 72 years old. I've never been to a comedy show.
Oh!
Yeah! So listen, one of my best friends, used to be my best friend until Trump came around.
No.
So, he was 87. He died a couple of months ago.
Oh, okay. A lot of information.
So, anyway. Hold on, you're distracting me there.
No, don't worry.
So anyway, he's also blind for most of his life. And I really got along with him. He's a good friend. I used to give him a ride to Chinatown. Came on his seeing eye dog. But one day we decided we're going to go to Patsy's.
Oh, yeah.
There's a pastrami comes
that's
in.
Like okay, that.
So. Anyway, so.
Shut up! You shut up about my heritage!
So we walk into Katz's. I'm a little nervous. It was half crowded, you know. So we're walking back, and there's this guy sitting on a table eating, like, a sandwich and, you know, really enjoying it. And half a sandwich is on the plate, you know. So the dog just leans over, and in a blink of an eye, it was faster than you could see, he just inhaled the half a sandwich. So I see the guy, like, he opened his mouth. He was in disbelief. And I decided executive decision right there. Just keep walking. Pretend I didn't see it. So, on the way back, I'm saying, well, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? We'll buy him another sandwich, you know? So anyway, we get to the back, we sit down, and guy never came, so, and I never told Tony about it. So that's it.
Oh, give it to you. That's awesome. Give it up for Andres.
Give it up for Andres, everybody.
Give it up for Andres.
Okay. Right now, what is about to happen is Drexton has never had pastrami before, so he is about to eat pastrami for the first time. What do you think you're about to eat?
It looks like roast beef or like a corned beef hash kind of situation. Like it looks like ham. It looks like a ham sandwich. Yeah.
How have you gone this long living in New York without eating any pastrami?
Well, I spend a lot of time in Harlem, and we have these things called chopped cheeses. I feel like pastrami is very much like a below the Central Park Beltline thing. So I've just never had it, but today is the day. I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah, I will say, pastrami below 110th Street. And then once you get above 110th Street, it's chopped cheese town.
Chopped cheese town. So I've been used to chopped cheese town, but I'm okay with trying pastrami. Today is going to be the day. I think we're going to make it happen.
All right, let's try this. Can I suggest no bread on this? Just take,
no
take not yet. Take just like take some out. Take a chunk out.
I'm gonna take a chunk.
Yeah.
Boom. Perfect. Right
this here. Is. There you go. Okay, right. He's gonna take it.
All right. Got the pastrami. Is that all right? Oh my god, this is delicious.
Oh.
This is so good. It's like smoky. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's salty, but not too seasoned. Yeah. It's tender. It just melts in your mouth. I love this.
Is this incredible?
This is incredible. And then the mustard really sets it off. Like, I don't need anything else. I thought I needed, like, mayo. Like, all these other sauces because the bread was so dry looking. But, oh, my God. This is so good.
Do you taste any of the anti-Semitism struggles, tenement living, any of that? Can you taste any of that in these sandwiches?
I feel like I'm tasting the struggles of your people. Now that I know that your slavery was worse, I feel...
Finally, you admit it.
No, it's really good. It's really good. Thank you, man. So we can confirm the NYC restaurant community is not dead.
To say it has been a rough year for restaurants in NYC would be a gross understatement. Food establishments were crippled by coronavirus, leaving institution after institution shuttered.
Some places had to transform their entire business model overnight, many becoming small-scale food shipping companies just to keep their doors open.
But the restaurant business in this city is still standing strong. And as long as New Yorkers are hungry, it isn't going anywhere.
Like the subway system, fire department, and hospital corps, NYC's cooks, waitstaffs, and delivery workers are a vital part of this city's ecology, showing up every day on the front line, keeping this city fed.
And a friendly reminder, just cause you had to spend 6 months door dashing your dinner doesn't mean the people behind the counter weren't working their asses off to get it to you.
Sure, we're not at 100% capacity, but at least NYC got outdoor dining now. We took all of the fun of drinking outside in New Orleans and added rush hour traffic and couples fighting in the street because their studio apartments were too small to fight in.
Take some time to think about the restaurant servers, cooks, owners, and delivery staff that have kept you satisfied throughout 2020. And remember to tip them. And not just once to feel good about yourself, but every single time, even if it's just for a cup of coffee.
Without the restaurant industry, this city dies.
Sure, you may find a bolt in your sushi every now and then, but that's just the price of doing business in New York City, baby.
And sure,
Indoor dining capacity limits change every other week, but Instagram influencers are still traveling to frickin' Astoria, Queens just to take pictures of fancy donuts at Comfortland for gram likes. So how bad could the dining experience in the city currently be?
And yes, people may not be faking an orgasm while eating pastrami at Katz's Deli right now, but you know what? We'll do that for you. Because if anyone believes in the power of the restaurant industry to make it through the pandemic, it's us.
NYC is the hill we're dying on. And if you want to join us, get Bill de Blasio on the phone and let him know. NYC is Dead is a production of Embassy Row. Our executive producers are Julia Cassidy, Eden Sudley, Anna Marie Johnson, and Leslie King. This episode was produced by us, Drexen Clemens and Eitan Levine, a.k.a. the Pastrami Boys. This show is edited by Maureen Begas.
You can follow us on Instagram at thisguydrex, at Eitan the Goalie, and at NYC is Dead Podcast. Or email the show at nycisdeadpodcast@gmail.com. See you next week.
We're in Katz's right now. No one has moaned here since before the pandemic. No one. No one has moaned here since before the pandemic.
Until now. So New York reopens the second someone moans in Katz's.
Oh my God. Oh, it's right there.
Oh my God.
There it is.
Guys, we did it. Ah, what he's having.